I wish this were a real talk show so that every time I introduce, please welcome James Finn Garner, we play the theme music for Rockford Files.
There's worse things to be associated with.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its 20th year, number 999, PC Peter Pan. Almost 10 years ago, exactly 500 episodes ago, in fact, on episode 499, I interviewed author James Finn Garner about his best-selling satire from the 1990s called Politically Correct Bedtime Stories. Well, Jim has a new book out now called Politically Correct Peter Pan, so I asked him how different it was now to apply a PC filter to a classic tale, and as you'll hear, his furnace kicked on just as he started to answer.
Well, it's interesting because some of the things I was making fun of 30 years ago are completely accepted now. The one that comes to mind is I made fun of the back in the early 90s, people started saying people of color.
Yeah.
And it struck me as odd, and it struck me as adjacent to colored people.
Yeah.
And it just kind of weirded me out, but I made a couple jokes about it in 94 and 95 in the book. And now that's the common term. So things change. It's kind of a wagon that you can put a lot of things on, but still in all, it's the language is the funny part. I mean, the language is the fun of these things because, you know, in the Peter Pan book, I've got a whole chapter called Pansplaining. So when he's explaining to Wendy and the Darling Children all about his views of the island. And then later on, Wendy has a spoiler alert. She's got kind of a Blue Lagoon sexual awakening at the island. And Peter says, well, this is that sex thing the pirates always talk about, right? Well, I'm not going to fall for that till I'm ready. I do things my way. And when I'm ready, I'm going to be the world's first pansexual. And Wendy and Tinkerbell kind of laughed themselves sick over that. And he's not at this rate, you won't.
Is this one of those books that you've created because of or despite popular demand?
Both, of course. the current one, PC Peter Pan. I was approached about 4 years ago or just in the middle of COVID by a publisher who wanted to do... he said, Jim, I like your books. I think we should do some woke fairy tales. What do you think? And in my head, I thought, stupid idea. But I said, sure, let's do it. And I wrote a couple. I wrote Peter Pan, and I wrote like half of Alice. And I also have Pinocchio ready to go. And then after like 2 months, he just disappeared. He's completely ghosted me.
Yeah.
And he's still head of the publishing. I mean, it's like, I don't know why he phoned me. Because like some fever dream he had, picked up the phone, called me, and then just ignored me the entire time. He never even saw the samples. So yeah. I was stuck with a couple of 12,000 word stories that I liked a lot. I mean, I always wanted to move into these longer formats. Like, you know, we started with bedtime stories and shorter things. So let's move to the chapter books, you know, like Peter Pan and Alice. And so I had these things written and I liked them. So I thought we will figure out a different way to get this out in people's hands.
That's lovely. And you are prolific. I mean, you are constantly writing. Is that a... I mean, I think writers are writers who write.
Yes.
And that's, I'm always writing when it's, my writing is always project dependent. But is that true for you, or you just get out and you write every day?
I write every day, but I like to have deadlines and I like to have markets. Because otherwise, I'm not a guy who like, oh, this has to come out of me. I am not that guy. But with a couple of markets I have found recently, it gives me enough motivation to get going. you know, I've been doing this 30 years, and I would love a monthly deadline, but it just doesn't come, you know. So between a couple of, I write often for a company called Ahoy Comics, because they like take short comic pieces, short stories. I just sent them out something this morning called Ask Dr. Fear, which is a advice column from a supervillain. see if they go for it. My favorite one for them that I just wrote was King Minos addresses rumors of human sacrifice, and it's King Minos on Crete with the Minotaur and his wife and all that stuff, and it's a very strange thing. But I'd like to make sure it gets in someone's hands. So right. With self-publishing is a good avenue. The Substack we talked about is a good avenue. You need a little bit of discipline, but I also like to make sure people are reading it, and that's kind of a. I don't want to work on something for 13 years and no one reads it. You know, regardless.
Right, you're not journaling. You're writing to be read by other people.
Right, right, and performing was something that got me back into writing. Many years ago, and so it's always like I'm writing for someone. I want to look clever. I want to look like the guy they can't live without, and that's you need a market for that.
Yeah. Do you find it hard, like in these chapter books? So a short story is one thing, and chapter books are a different thing. Do you find it hard, or is it a thing you worry about keeping narrative momentum going in and amongst around the jokes?
Sure, that's a concern, but I think I've got a good handle on it because back in my early 30s, late 20s, early 30s, a friend of mine and I, Pat Burns, were writing radio dramas to perform on stage. Yeah. And they always screwed up, and they were of different lengths, but I didn't realize I was learning it, but I learned then a little bit about momentum and a little about tension and about where to end a chapter or where to how to just keep it rolling. And you know, I've written a couple of novels and I have to go through 7 or 8 you know, pass throughs for it, and I do pay attention to that because, you know, I'm not writing 100 Years of Solitude. I am writing stupid stories about circus people and Peter Pan, you know.
Yeah. So,
but it's what I do, it's what I love.
When you're doing all of these drafts, do you sort of edit as you go? Is your first draft just a stream of consciousness? Get it down so I got something to go back and edit and fix?
Yeah, it's got to be. I love the editing part. I don't like the writing part, but I love the editing part because you can see little ponies in the pile of shit, and you can pull them out and say, oh, that's pretty good. And then you start linking things and you start just refining the atmosphere and the voice, and that's what I'd love to do. The first draft is tough, and you got to have faith in yourself and the process. And without that, you wouldn't pick up a pen. But I just do love I love having done it, and I love having the editing in front of me, just to get done, because it's just more fun. It's more. The internal pace is lower. Like when I'm creating, the pace is heightened and it's kind of tough and it wears me down. Editing, the pace is slower and I can see what's going on.
You talked about your acting background and your performing background, but you also mentioned, you know, King Minos. So you clearly have a classical and literary background as well. Is that something you came by naturally? Did you study this in order to become a writer, or these are just the things you have in your head, in the desk in your head?
I've got a lot of depths in my head. Yes, it's true. No, I went to Catholic all-boys school, so I know my Latin. Went to the University of Michigan, so I know my great books and my all that stuff. And King Minos came out because we took a trip a few years ago to Crete to visit family, and I thought it was just fascinating the way history is, like, right on the surface in Crete and in a lot of Greece. And so I just thought, well, let's see, your son is half man, half bull, and he has to eat Athenian people. to stay alive. So how does that work on your public image? You know, and your wife gave birth to him after building a contraption to mate with a bull. Is this something that has gotten in the way of your public life? So I don't know. I don't know where it comes from, but I'm glad it's still coming. You know.
Well, I mean, but it's an endless source of material. Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons that I keep diving into Shakespeare. You know, anything I want to write has probably already been written and in iambic pentameter. So I might as well have fun with that, build on that, acknowledge the stuff that comes before me and play that. Play with
exactly.
That.
Exactly. And it resonates with people. And in Western culture, other things resonate. That's why I like to write parodies of hard-boiled detective stories, because that people know where you're coming from, and you can't write the new Raymond Chandler, but you can really play with it.
Hi, my name is Lauren Gunderson. I'm the playwright for The Book of Will, among other plays, and you are listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSE the RSE? In the first half of 2026, we'll be performing All the Great Books Abridged in Reston, Virginia, and Sault Ste. Marie and Holland, Michigan. And we'll be bringing back the show that started it all, the complete works of William Shakespeare abridged to more than 30 cities in the UK. And next Monday night, February 2nd, 2026, we'll have a special live recording of the 1,000th episode of the RSE podcast on stage at Chicago's famed Annoyance Theater, where I'll be talking to the Annoyance's founder and artistic director, Mick Napier, and his executive director, Jennifer Eslin. The show starts at 7 p.m., and you can check out the touring page at our website, reducedshakespeare.com, or the Annoyance Theater's website at theannoyance.com, or our social media pages for venue and ticket information. And now back to my conversation with James Finn Garner, talking about his new book, Politically Correct, Peter Pan. You're catching a wave in terms of Peter Pan because Lauren Gunderson, America's most produced playwright, has written an adaptation of Peter Pan that foregrounds Wendy. I think it's called Wendy and Peter. And then I just saw that I think it's maybe the Royal Shakespeare Company, or maybe possibly the National Theater, is also foregrounding Wendy, but they're calling it Peter and Wendy. And I always go, ah, but they're not using Lauren Gunderson's adaptation. It's like, I always wonder, gosh, where do these people get their ideas? When I see a play out there called The Complete Works of Jane Austen Abridged, I've had more people reach out to me going, hey, is this your? No, it's not. It's not us. Right. We didn't do it.
Right. Well, when my PC bedtime stories came out in 94, 95, there were like a dozen parodies of it, of me parodying something else. So it came out with conservative bedtime stories and legally correct bedtime stories and all these things. So, you know, it's just whatever.
And that was it. I remember that time period 30 years ago so well, because we were writing The Complete History of America Abridged, and I wrote our PC national anthem, you know, making the argument that we should have a better national anthem that isn't so militaristic, patriarchal, and impossible to sing. So it became, oh, beautiful for spacious skies and non-exploited waves of botanical companions mounted majesties of color and free roaming non-human beings beside the differently harvested plain.
See, you stole my idea right there.
No, we were both in the air. Paddling in the same shallow end of the pool.
So you say.
I didn't even know you back then.
I know. I think satire is very important and doesn't get enough respect. You know, it is important, and it can be broad, or it can be tasteful or narrow focused, but it's something we need to scrape the barnacles off our brain, especially today, you know.
Yeah. I just read a review of the new documentary about Mel Brooks, and the reviewer in Rolling Stone, and David Fear in Rolling Stone, was saying You know, we need this combination of high and low humor even more than we used to. And when your starting place is one of the classic works of literature, you can celebrate the high, but you can really only go low.
Yeah, I can pretend I read a lot, you know.
Yeah. Do you have did you want to read an excerpt?
Sure. I can read the beginning.
Cool.
A very good place to start. Oh, that's a different movie. this is chapter one called Escaping Imperialism. In the center of a park in the center of London, the center of a world-strangling empire that was squeezing the life out of one quarter of the world's persons, the Darling children were taking the air, tastefully and reservedly. There was Wendy, the firstborn chronologically, who was virtue signaling by reading from the Anglican Book of Daily Devotions. John, the medially positioned child, read the Financial Times and dreamed of new systems for economic exploitation. And Michael, the sibling with the greatest inexperience, read an age-appropriate book about pirates, because deep in his rapacious Anglo-Saxon heart, he knew that these ancestors were his role models. Standing on guard there in Kensington Gardens was their faithful animal companion, Nana, whose devotion had been manipulated in custodial obligation. Where the children's actual parents were, no one knew, but because of the color of their skin, no one complained about them to the pre-adult welfare authorities. So, you know, the verbiage slips in, like I could slip in virtue signaling in an easy way. It's just, they're fun to read out loud because they stumble on all their, you know, all the footnotes. It's like, maybe it's like doing verbal footnotes.
And it's a way of looking at the original story going, oh, yeah, that's exactly what, that's exactly what Michael would be reading. You know, he would absolutely become a tool and engine of empire growing up.
And the littlest one being a pirate, and I do blend in towards the end. Lord of the Flies comes in a little bit. So,
yeah,
it would, you know,
absolutely.
The Lost Boys in this one are the Loud Boys, and they have a campground in the forest to protect themselves against their enemies, which include pointy-headed East Coast intellectuals and cat ladies. So they do lots of screaming and running around. And masturbating. So.
Pointy-headed East Coast intellectuals. Oh, I feel seen.
Yes, exactly. But you see how it's just like breaking it apart. And Peter needs Ritalin really badly. You know, when you read the book, he's always crowing and stuff. And it's like, dude, slow down.
Yeah, well, and that's a diagnosis that has changed just in my lifetime about, you know, what Peter is, how he should be treated, how he should be medicated.
And how much, you know, no one wants to grow up. Well, how many people that we know are all about, oh, I'm never going to grow up. I always have that child in me, and that's why I don't have a job, or that's why I like to go off in the woods all day and blow stuff up.
I do love that the verb adulting. You know, because none of us love it, and we all have to do it.
Yeah. Oh, I've got to do the adulting. My favorite verb I didn't use in this is MacGyvering.
Ooh, yeah, yeah.
That's my favorite new verb. Got to MacGyver that sucker.
Well, and there are times when I feel like I have to dress like a grown-up to go do something. Otherwise, I'd be in T-shirts and jeans all day.
Yeah, but you and I are writers and actors, and we can, like, do that. That's why we did this, you know.
Right.
If you have a real job, dress like an adult.
Yes.
You and I don't have real jobs. We pay for that in some ways, and the benefits include dressing like a kid.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, except for one more thing, which I'll share with you in about 60 seconds, so stick around. James Finn Garner's new book, Politically Correct Peter Pan, is available almost anywhere books are sold. Send us your favorite classic tale that needs wokening via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com, or throw comments to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, reducedshakespeare.com, or visit my website, theshakespeareans.com. Thanks, as always, to Lost Boy Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Danica Finch. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to playwright Lauren Gunderson, whose own reimagining, Peter Pan and Wendy, can be found at newplayexchange.org. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 999 2997ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
Do you ever wish that you had done something different with your life, James Finn Garner?
The only time I think that is when I'm on jury duty and I watch prosecutors and I think, that's an easy job. I could bullshit people into jail. But it would never have worked, you know. It would never have worked. I'm very happy. I'm very fortunate that this is what I wanted to do since about the age of 14, and I found a way to make it and support my family with it. So I'm always happy about it, even the mornings when nothing's happening in the cabeza.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less. So much less. So much less. So much less. So much less.